Several years ago, I interviewed an author named Lisa Dickey about her book, Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia. A look into the daily life in Russia over a 20-year time period that documented and sought to dispel misconceptions that Russia was a cold and hard country where bears freely walked around on Russian streets. No, Lisa Dickey isn't our guest this week, but we will hear from someone else with connections to Russia who believes that there are some misconceptions he would like to clear up. I'm Clay Aiken. It's Thursday, September 10th, and this week, Politicon welcomes Carter Page, a man who some consider a martyr, others consider a pariah, and who considers himself an innocent American framed in an attempted coup against a president. Regardless of where one comes down on the question of whether or not Russia interfered in the American elections in 2016, and regardless of whether or not one believes President Trump's campaign colluded with Russia in any such attempt, Carter Page has a plausible argument that he was just caught up in a scandal that he was not a part of. And since the end of investigations into Russian interference, he remains one of the only Trump advisors to have been vindicated and cleared by both the Mueller report and federal courts. This week, he talks to us about his book, Abuse and Power, How an Innocent American Was Framed in an Attempted Coup Against the President. And he weighs in, for the first time, on whether or not he believes this president deserves a second term. Is Russia a threat to the United States? Have the current president's tactics towards Russia been appropriate and effective? Should we worry about further interference in the elections this November? And how the heck are we going to get along? You've had a rough go over the past few years yourself, which obviously...
I joke about that, and we can get into it. But I, you know, basically my life, you know, what people have dealt with over the course of the last several months is like what I've been dealing with, you know, it feels like more consistently going back since, you know, the last presidential election. Just always kind of, you know, because I was under a lot of pressure. And so, you know, with a ton of death threats coming in, I was sort of, suffice to say, I've had my time quarantined on my own, you know, back some time.
Have you felt the need to kind of stay hidden away during all of this? I mean, is it got bad enough that you felt not safe yourself?
Yeah. And unfortunately, I mean, that's kind of part of this whole saga when you're asking for help from the FBI, and not only are they not helping you, but they're coming after you even more for various retribution purposes. And everyone thought I was crazy until this Inspector General report eventually came out and showed that I was, you know, it was even worse than what I had been claiming. So crazy.
You didn't necessarily start out hoping to be involved in like presidential politics initially, though. When you went to the Naval Academy, you obviously went to school for international affairs, but did you ever intend to be a part of the political side of this at all?
No, you know, it's funny, and that's interesting way you frame it, because I mean the way people are sort of insiders break it out is there's kind of three parts to political campaigns. One is politics, the other is sort of media relations, and the third is policy, you know, sort of the more substantive, down in the weeds stuff. And I was really the latter. I mean, that's kind of what I've been involved in throughout most of my career, and, you know, having worked in a number of think tanks, et cetera. So the political and the media side were never things that I had any interest in, but unfortunately some actors wrote me into various things.
Right. Do you feel like, right, obviously I want to make sure that people know you've got your book, Abuse and Power, How an Innocent American Was Framed in an Attempted Coup Against the President, is out. And I want to talk to you some about that, but I'm always interested a little bit in the story before the story. So how you got involved in not necessarily President Trump's campaign specifically, but how you got involved in Russian foreign policy and foreign policy in general. You went to school for you got your PhD at University of London, yeah?
Yes. Yeah.
In foreign relations, in international affairs? Is that what you wanted to do?
In Middle and Near East studies, which was, I mean, it's sort of a regional studies approach, but it was really multidisciplinary.
Why that?
Similarly, it's kind of political economy, right? You know, the political economy of Central Asia was.
What interested you in that region in general? I mean, why? Obviously Russia's a big deal, and the Middle East is a big deal, but Central Asia, you're talking about a bunch of stands that aren't necessarily real big players on the foreign policy front, but they do have a lot of natural resources. Is that what got you drawn to that area?
You know, frankly speaking, I was a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York when I got out of the Navy, and through, it was sort of one thing led to another, and me and another guy ended up starting a research program related to Central Asia. Actually, more precisely, the Caspian Sea region, which is partially Central Asia, Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan, border the Caspian Sea, but there's also Russia and Azerbaijan, et cetera.
So you just sort of fell into that area, essentially. It was a project-based thing, and you just sort of fell in love with it. Is that accurate?
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, a lot is, you know, some of it sort of developed over time. And, you know, one opportunity led to another. And actually, to be totally precise, the fifth country that borders the Caspian Sea is Iran. And so I, during my year at the Council on Foreign Relations, I did a number of trips to Tehran and throughout the country, and was part of some research projects related to that as well.
And so you got a lot of expertise, especially in that area. And you got some expertise, obviously, in Russia, and not just foreign relations, but there was some business relations as well. I mean, kind of give folks a bit of a background in how you ended up translating that experience and those research projects into your foreign policy expertise on Russia, because you were essentially, is it inaccurate to say that you were the Russia expert for President Trump?
Well, that's another example of how things sometimes, you know, we had a group that, of volunteers that got together, and we were all, you know, a lot of us had a lot of experience in, you know, worldwide. And I mean, as a reality, I did a lot related to many countries, including China, Africa, Middle East, etc. But again, just driven by the storyline and the, you know.
Well, I don't want to drive the storyline. I want to let you know, that's why I said, is it accurate if you were? You don't think you were some people believed and assumed. I think the Senate intelligence report, I'm not going to use exact words because I don't have them, but you can tell me if they're accurate. They essentially said that Russia and may have believed that you were more involved than you were with the campaign. I mean, somehow there was a connection between Russia and you, and then you had a connection to the Trump campaign, and arguably some people may have misinterpreted that. It certainly has, that misinterpretation certainly has given you quite the past 3 years, but how did those assumptions develop?
Well, I think, you know, it's a fair point, and, but I think along the lines of what you're alluding to, sort of perception eventually becomes reality. And when my life got taken over by this entire scandal, the truth is Russia was much more than it ever had been in terms of where my attention was focused, et cetera. And actually, in reality, in the last presidential election cycle, I think where it did become sort of a constant theme is that when political operatives, consultants to the DNC and the Democrats were reaching out to the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Washington Post, and giving these same allegations, which turned out to be false, than it did, as a matter of fact, become more a focus than it otherwise would have been if I were telling my story or being able to live my life as I had liked. But, to your point on Senate Intelligence Committee, as someone noted today, I think it must have been some statement, I guess, from Marco Rubio, where he said he's very proud of his committee. And he says there's been no issues with information sort of leaks and leaks of classified information. And unfortunately, the one initial conviction in a Russia-related case was the quote-unquote security director of Senator Rubio's committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, who was leaking to, again, in a media context, where he was leaking to his then-girlfriend and got a false statement charge and was convicted for a felony related to that. So it all, there's a lot of...
You concede that there are issues, that there are bipartisan issues then, that Republicans are leaking and Democrats are leaking, and that there generally seems to be, do you think that it's a one-sided issue? Do you think both sides have a problem with keeping their mouth shut? Like, who are you mad at, Carter? Who are you mad at the most?
Well, I'm not really mad at anyone. I just want this situation to be resolved where there's just been so much false information going back so many years that I'm just concerned about the impact that it's had and the impact that it's continued to have. I mean, again, like I'm describing and like I talk about in my book, there were things driving the narrative in the last presidential election cycle. And sure enough, now, again, today, there are, these same phenomena are happening once again, where a lot of false impressions and sometimes, spin and various people with agendas end up driving a narrative that turns out to be pretty detached from reality. But I'm sure you can think of a lot of other examples.
Just got to talking and I didn't give much context to folks who are listening, just so I want to back up a bit. There, the Russia investigation, the Mueller probe, whatever, the different arms of the investigation into President Trump's campaign and his contacts with or connection to or potential or alleged collusion with Russia, a lot of that was traced back by many to you specifically. And you were one of the first people who initially was accused of being a potential conduit between the Trump campaign and contacts in Russia. For those people who are listening and unaware, FISA warrants were issued to surveil you before and during that campaign. And it has been discovered and pretty much validated by a lot of judges, both conservative appointed and liberal appointed judges, that those FISA warrants were not necessarily enacted, you may want to say legally, but they weren't necessarily, the proper procedures weren't followed in issuing those FISA warrants. Have I summed that part up accurately, do you think, or is there something you want to add or take away?
Well, I think you have it, Clay, broadly speaking. But unfortunately, and this is sort of one of my current projects in terms of trying to set the record straight, is unfortunately, you know, the full story is not really completely understood right now. There are so many things in these range of ongoing intelligence investigations, which there hasn't been full disclosure about. And that's what I've tried to do in terms of setting the record straight. So, for example, I mean, I think what you're broadly referring to, and in terms of the, you know, the various court actions, the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court in Washington, you know, they've made some pretty damning statements about what has happened. But unfortunately, and a lot of that was driven by an Obama-appointed U.S. Department of Justice Inspector General, who came out last December with a 480-page massive report, kind of talking about all of these problems, as he refers to it, 17 errors and omissions. But unfortunately, I was essentially blocked from having any input into that, even though a lot of the same people who were actually involved in the crimes were the ones providing the testimony. So unfortunately, it's remained quite a half story, and it's complicated, but really exciting when you stop and think about it, and you know, because it's sort of a real life spy thriller. And
well, the reason I wanted to frame it that way for folks who are listening is because I think that part of the discussion here can be had regardless of whether you fall on the side of Trump colluded with Russia, Trump didn't collude with Russia, Russia interfered, Russia didn't interfere. I think that the interesting part of this story is sort of how, just like the subtitle to your book is how, I'm going to use your words, I'm not making my own up, but how an innocent American was framed in an attempted coup against the president. I mean, it's a pretty incendiary and disruptive subtitle, but this is in a way a story of someone who probably didn't necessarily intend to get into, like you said, the political part of this, but instead involved themselves in the policy part of it, and then sort of did get wrapped up into a political storm. And I'm not passing judgment on anyone or either side. I'm trying to frame the story in that way because I wonder if you ever have moments where you think, God, I wish I had never gotten involved with the campaign at all. Do you?
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, I skipped, you reminded me of a point you raised earlier, Clay, that I should have, there's a lot of moving parts and I skipped over one part in terms of, you know, bad actors on both sides. Let me say a little bit more about that, because although essentially this whole, infamous dossier, which was put together by consultants in and around Washington, this group called Fusion GPS. Yes, they were paid by the DNC and the Democrats in 2016. But and this is actually a quote from that Senate Intelligence Report that you were just referring to, where it says, in the fall of 2015, Fusion GPS signed a contract with Paul Singer and the Washington Free Beacon. Now, coincidentally, and I'm not sure how much of a coincidence it is, but that same time in the fall of 2015, you know, there was a New York Times article, which I think says a lot, where Maggie Haberman, the title of the article is that Paul Singer, influential billionaire, throws support to Marco Rubio for president. So again, it's a small world when the person who's at the center and beginning this whole Russia madness in terms of hiring Fusion GPS, as we now know from this report that was just disclosed by Senator Rubio's committee, 5 years earlier, you know, one of his biggest donors, if not the biggest donor, was the one starting this whole charade, unfortunately, or hired the group that ended up, you know, bringing us down this crazy path. So, yes, I would actually agree with you that there are some people who have not been too, you know,
well, listen, now you got
it's not just one side.
You've got a bunch of axes to grind, and I won't try to take away your opportunity to grind them. And people can certainly get your book and hear them ground all they want to in the book. But the goal here with this podcast is, how the heck are we going to get along? And I know that it's a little different. It's a little interesting having you on as a guest, because you have some beef with some folks. And typically with other guests, we try to say, well, you know, let's prevent ourselves from accusing such and such of this or such and such of that. So it's a little bit of a different dance for me to take today, because, well, you've gone through a lot and you have some people you're upset with. But do you think that, let me just think, do you think Marco Rubio or President Obama or Joe Biden should be in jail for surveilling you or for leaking information or for being involved in this? I guess I don't want to ask you to accuse someone of something, but the president has done it. The president has said that Joe Biden and President Obama should be arrested for allowing surveillance of you. Do you agree with that?
Clay, you know, I actually, let me side with you a little bit in terms of, you know, finding ways of getting along, if you will. I mean, to me, and, you know, again, those points that I just made, I was just reading from Maggie Haberman in the New York Times, who, I mean, these are just straight facts of how this all started. So it's not, I wouldn't characterize it as grinding an axe. I'm just, trying to fill out the stories to make sure people understand what actually happened. And I'm fully with you. I agree. I think, and, you know, I appreciate you framing it that way. And I think that's the most important thing in terms of, you know, finding ways that we can start working together better in this country, as opposed to these constant confrontations. But I think as a starting point to that, it could be very helpful to actually have a, you know, the basic information. And I think, again, going back to that same framework of the way someone had once portrayed the political realm to me, of, you know, the policy side, the political side, and the media side of campaigns. And again, they're all interrelated. But I think, to me, what's in the end of the day, probably the most interesting and the most substantive, is the policy side. And I think, unfortunately, what has happened, and exactly to your point, I think, you know, it's important that we find ways of interacting better. And I the part of the problem is, I think if we're always pointing the finger at the other person or the other group, then, you know, we really lose that opportunity. And so I completely hear where you're going with that, and I fully agree. And I think there's a lot that should be done. But, you know, just to kind of put a
I'm not trying to muffle you. I want you to say how you feel.
I appreciate it. And I think, to me, that's actually more important, because if we're not having substantive policy debates, if everyone, let's just kind of look at it from the opposite perspective. You know, when people are always accusing the president and or his supporters of being Russian agents, you know, whether it's calling, you know, the Senate Majority Leader Moscow Mitch or something, you know, I mean, that
there is hyperbole there for sure. I'll agree with that.
There is. And I think,
but is,
yeah, it prevents serious discussion, I think.
But is there not? Would you argue that there is no reason to be concerned about Russia in the United States? I mean, I will agree with you that Moscow Mitch and those types of hyperbolic accusations in bed with Russia, Moscow, Mitch, Biden is the pawn of the Ukraine or China. All of that stuff is just hyperbole. But is there no concern in your mind? I mean, you know a lot about what's going on in Russia. You've got connections and contacts in that country. Do you think that there's no reason to be concerned at all in the U.S.? Is that fair? Or should we honestly look at some of these accusations of Russia interfering in the United States political process and look at them with a serious eye?
I think it's a fair question, and I agree with you, right?
What do you agree with? Yeah. I can't, with the fact that the question's fair or the fact that they're interfering?
I think it's fair to ask the question. And unfortunately...
Well, I'm asking you. I'm not asking you to ask it. I'm asking you to answer it.
Well, no, you framed it as, does it make sense to, you know, investigate these issues, think through these issues? And I don't see any problem with that. What I do see a problem with is this ad hominem rhetoric, which becomes so toxic that anyone who even voices any opinion which is less than complete damnation of Russia and Moscow.
Okay, I'll agree with that.
And President Putin nonstop. Anyone who's sort of painted into that corner, I think, is unfortunate. And
I'll agree with that. And you won't get that. You won't get that from me. But I'll say, I do my best to not pretend that I'm not biased. I'm openly biased, and I own it. But to me, I do find myself concerned with the same things that Richard Burr, who is not in my political party, but he himself has mentioned have concerned him when he was chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that there have been moves by Russia to interfere with presidential elections, that there was malware placed inside of certain ballot machines in parts of Florida by Russia. That's what I am concerned about. You won't hear from me that you are a Russian agent if you disagree with me, but I will disagree with you. But I am curious, do you not find those things specifically to be concerning? Do you think they're not a threat? Do you think Russia is not a threat and doesn't care about how what's going on over in the United States? Or do you think they're involving themselves in ways they shouldn't?
I would not say that they're not a threat, but all I would say, on the other hand, is there are ways of dealing with that threat that are a lot smarter and a lot more effective than constantly throwing stones at our quote unquote adversary nonstop. And let me tell you something.
How would you do it then? I mean, you're a policy expert, so I would love how would you approach it? Because those things. So we have agreed here. We've found a place that we can agree that there is a threat. And we might even agree that constantly throwing stones isn't the way to solve it. We have certainly used carrots and sticks in other parts of the world successfully. Yeah. How would you address those types of threats from Russia right now?
I think a lot of it comes down to having a constructive dialogue, right? And this, again, this is, I don't know if you have kids, but if you're constantly telling your, a member of your family they're bad, bad, bad all the time, sooner or later, it doesn't really help the relationship.
I do have a child, and I know that doesn't work. And I also have parents, a mother who and uncles who vote for Donald Trump. And I also know that telling them that's not good is not going to work. So I'm with you. Yeah. I agree that it doesn't. But I don't necessarily feel like my mother or my son or my uncle are adversaries. So I get the whole philosophy, the psychological philosophy of not telling people they're wrong, because I think politically in the US we do that way too much. We say people are wrong, and once you tell them they're wrong, they stop listening. But does that work on a foreign policy level when you're talking about a country that is trying to do potentially do harm to our democratic system is talking and trying to get them to see the error of their ways and saying, please don't. Is that going to work?
I think, let me just say, I think in many instances, the threat has been overstated. And I think by tempering it so much, somewhat, that it can be productive. And let me just say, this is now speaking from firsthand experience.
So tell me where it's been overstated, please. Yeah. Do.
Well, I have not stepped foot in Russia since I was under agent of a foreign power surveillance by the CIA, FBI, NSA, and all the U.S. intelligence agencies. But what I can tell you for sure is, look, countries change. We have changed as a country, right? And
well, I'll give you that.
Well, but, you know, I think there's always opportunity for negotiations, right? And what I can tell you from firsthand experience, primarily just speaking with scholars and average people on the street in Moscow 4 years ago in 2016 when I went there, both in the summer during the before the election and in December right after the election, people are looking for new solutions. You know, they're not happy. I mean, the reality is our bad relationship. I mean, everything we're talking about now is the same thing people were talking about in the late 1940s in terms of, you know, Russia, the threat, et cetera. And the question then becomes, how do you get out of that threat? How do you?
So you think Russia has changed for the better?
I don't pass judgments like that, but I think there are ways. What I can tell you without question is there are certainly ways in which they could change for the better. And in many ways that they want to change for the better.
The people or the president of Russia? The people or Putin want to change for the better?
I'm not saying want. I'm saying, you know, life is a negotiation, right? There's always room for negotiate. And I think it was Kennedy that had that quote, right? You know, never negotiate in fear, never fear to negotiate. I mean, the reality is we've painted ourselves into a corner in many ways of, you know, it's all fear. And this goes back to the start of
when you see that people who are opponents of Vladimir Putin being poisoned, that stokes fear, don't you think? That doesn't say to me changing for the better. Does it say that to you?
Look, again, no one's perfect. And let me just say,
I will agree with you that would be not perfect.
Well, let me tell you something. When I was facing frequent, almost constant death threats, you know, there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of similarities, right? And if whether you're
death threats from a 400-pound person in their basement on Twitter, et cetera, is a little different than death threats from the president of your country, don't you think? I mean, listen, I've had death threats too, but I haven't had any from the president yet.
Well, look, you know, when your life is put at risk, and I mean, even by the terrorism statutes, a threat is, you know, it's like you're asking about, you know, are these things we should be concerned about? You know, by law, whether you actually blow up the building or threaten to blow up the building, I mean, by the U.S. terrorism statutes, those are equally illegal actions. And unfortunately, this mass hysteria, which again goes back to the fear, which has prevented any forward progress. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a serious problem, and it's something that needs to be addressed. And I think, you know, having a little bit more of an open mind and not, you know, constantly closing doors. I mean, there's good and bad ways of negotiation. And,
right, but do you think those same sorts of do you think that every country should be treated the same? If we found that the president of Brazil had worked to poison or been involved in poisoning potentially someone who was an opponent. Heck, we just saw Saudi Arabia and the problems there, where Jamal Khashoggi killed by folks who were connected potentially to MBS in Saudi Arabia. If we found out that that was happening in a place like Brazil or in a place like Rwanda or in really any other country, wouldn't we get a little bit pissed at Boris Johnson if we found out he had done that and not necessarily expect to use a carrot and stick approach? Is there a reason that there seems to be a little bit more willingness to be patient with a country like Russia than there might be with some other country if they did similar things?
Of course. I mean, everything, you know, you have to, and this is part of the issue. It's exactly the same argument I was making a few minutes ago. You know, I think an absolutist philosophy is rarely effective or rarely, you know, a good way of going about a problem, right?
So it's okay to be a little more lenient on some countries.
I would suggest so, right? And, you know, I think, and there are ways of doing it. This goes back to, you know, negotiating with family members as well, right? To the extent that, you know, there's different ways of having that conversation. Unfortunately, when we as a country or various actors within our country always have on the front page these often overworked or overstated threat assessments of how bad certain situations are, you know, often that can have a pretty negative impact. And it really does not leave open many positive alternatives. I mean, it becomes pretty much a catch-22 for officials in Washington in terms of the possibilities. Again, this is not a call for appeasement in any way or any sort of weak-kneed approach, but it is, you know, going in, it is a suggestion that it can be helpful to have a bit more of an open mind and a bit more of a way of looking for a constructive dialogue, which in turn can then lead to forward progress in many instances.
It's kind of interesting though to me because, I mean, Russia's sort of one of the few places in the few areas of discussion or policy in Washington, D.C., where there has been some pretty bipartisan agreement that they are not a friend or ally. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking of Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, as you mentioned, Ben Sasse, several Republicans who have said, you know, they're very concerned about the way the United States is relating to Russia and the threats that Russia poses to the United States. It's one of the few areas of agreement between parties that Russia's not our buddy. So do you understand, I guess, why people might say, how funny that the one thing that Democrats and Republicans seem to kind of have a consensus on, this particular president doesn't necessarily agree with them. Is that, do you see why that's weird?
Let me agree with you, Clay, and also note another example where we had a similar situation where there was bipartisan support. And that was 19 years ago, or 18 years ago now, in the lead up to the war in Iraq, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, there was consensus, both on the left and the right,
true,
that these guys are bad. And again, it's the same sort of situation, right? Where it's
In that situation, you had two parties and the president all agreeing that Iraq was
correct.
In this situation, you're talking about a bipartisan support within Congress, but the president being the one who's saying, no, we're not going to impose these particular sanctions, or we're not going to impose this particular aggression towards Russia. So it sounds like you're saying that in this case, you feel like President Trump is the only person in D.C. who is actually approaching this the correct way. Is that an accurate assessment?
And look, I would agree with that characterization. And I would also say it is a symbol to me of real leadership, right? I mean, it's easy. I mean, similar to the Iraq debacle, which cost our country 4,000 plus U.S. service members' lives, literally not billions of dollars, trillions of dollars in lost, money wasted in this unfortunate war. And to me, it's a sign of true leadership. I mean, it's easy.
Where did he get those thoughts from, do you think? I mean, because George W. Bush arguably was advised by, you know, his own father. He was certainly advised by Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. He had a lot of people advising him on his position towards Iraq. Where is Donald Trump getting his philosophy towards Russia? Because if he's not getting it from his own, from people in Congress on either side, on either party, and he's not getting it arguably from Dan Coats, who was director of national intelligence, who apparently has been open about his concerns that the president was not being aggressive enough towards Russia. I mean, where's he getting this philosophy? Because it seems like he just came out of New York, moved to D.C., and already had what you are calling, what you consider to be the one dude with the right answer. Like, he's the one guy in America who thinks we should be easier on Russia and take a softer stance with them. And I just don't understand. I mean, I knew him before, and when we were doing Apprentice, he sure didn't know much about Russia. So where did he get this philosophy from?
Well, let me just put a fine point on it. Let me be totally clear. I'm not saying a soft stance, right? I'm saying a more practical approach and a little bit of an open mind. I mean, and I think if you look, you know, several of the steps he has taken over the course of this administration is, you know, have been pretty harsh in terms of, you know, additional steps that have been contrary to Russia's interest. But, you know, there's an old saying, and you're asking my question of where did I come up with this idea, and where is he? Where do I think? Again,
if you gave him the idea, then I definitely want to know where you got it from. But I'm wondering where he got it.
I think, you know, it's a not to use an old cliche, but I mean, he's someone who has had a more practical, real world experience in terms of, you know, doing deals around the world and, you know, really understanding people as opposed to just being completely driven. I think one of the common denominators of the rest of the cast of characters that you're alluding to is, I mean, for the most part, these are individuals who have spent most of their career in, you know, in the Washington swamp, right?
Well, so Rex Tillerson had not. Rex Tillerson came from the same field of work that you had worked in too, right? I mean, oil and gas. And, and Rex Tillerson said, I mean, I can't remember exactly his quote, but Rex Tillerson spared very few words in saying that he thought Trump was not doing the best he could do.
Well, but let me kind of build upon, I mean, there's all sorts of challenges that everyone was dealing with during those very turbulent times in our country's history when you're talking late 2016 and early 2017 and the months that followed. But I think what's interesting, and you know, there was a lot of controversy. And I remember that time. I actually happened to be in Russia that week in early December of 2016, you know, just a little over a month after the 2016 election, when Rex Tillerson was named, right? And one of the big accomplishments of his career was doing some major energy deals between the US and Russia. And actually, you know,
still he doesn't think that Trump was handling it right. I mean, you kind of make that argument for me, right?
No, they had other sort of issues, is my understanding. Again, I've never been in a meeting with either of them, but you know, again,
is there anything Trump's not doing right in foreign policy, in your opinion?
You know, I think it's important to push back on the consensus. And I think he has done a tremendous
You're struggling with this here, Carter. you can't think of anything he's not doing right.
You know, I look at the big picture and I think overall he has done, you know, and I bear in mind, look, my vantage point, you know, when my life was essentially taken over by these continued controversies and when I'm still spend 12 plus hours a day. I mean, it's nice spending some time with you here, Clay, but I mean, most of my time is dealing with big legal battles, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not as tuned into that, but you know, I do understand, you know, to me, it's pretty just looking at the headlines and looking at some of the accomplishments he's had in terms of both Israel, UAE, that recent deal and, you know, ending the, being victorious in the war against ISIS, et cetera. I mean, there's a pretty long list of accomplishments.
Are the legal battles and the stuff you're dealing with, or that, is that why you haven't really been involved any at all? Not in the campaign, but I found it interesting as I was trying to research and make sure I was ready to talk to you. There's very little, if any whatsoever, from you in the public eye when it comes to this particular election and whether or not I assume you plan to vote for Donald Trump. If I'm wrong, tell me, but do you still support him? You haven't really said much about his reelection and whether or not you think he's doing well enough to have another term.
Well, Clay, this goes to the point of my book, Abuse and Power. I mean, I am seriously concerned about the problems and the election interference that happened the last time around in the prior presidential election. And I think just based on core accomplishments and based on things he's somehow managed to pull off, despite having all these manufactured headwinds by his political adversaries, I think he's definitely earned another 4-year term without question. You know, it's hard enough to even survive in the midst of, you know, and I'm speaking from firsthand experience when you're constantly being called a Russian agent, a Russian stooge, agent of a foreign power nonstop for years. I mean, to still be able to lead a country and, continue pushing forward.
Obviously, as I've said before, my producers will drink, tip their glasses when I say I own my bias, but I'm going to say it again. Obviously, I do. Yeah. And I am not going to vote for Trump, but I got to say that's not the most ringing endorsement to say that you think he's done a good job considering how tough it's been, that he survived.
It is a strong endorsement. I'm just stating that as a base case. I think his accomplishments have been incredible. I think his platform and what he stands for at this stage. And again, particularly from a foreign policy standpoint and from an economic standpoint, I think, you know, he's done an incredible job and there's a lot more upside where that came from. And again, you know, and this comes back to my story as well. You know, if the government has full control over someone's life, similar to what I was subjected to, you know, it's a real problem. And I think, relatively speaking, these are core principles of the respective parties, right? Where one is more strong central government power and the other is more power to the people and, you know, let people, you know, more of a laissez-faire, let people live their lives as free individuals. Having been through the gauntlet and having known firsthand the downside of having massive government forces come down upon you like a load of bricks, I definitely appreciate it. And I know for sure that, these are things that people are, it's in their best interest to avoid, you know, particularly over the longer term.
Let me move on to our quick fire questions. We asked folks earlier in the week told them that you would be on this week and asked them to send in their questions. You can do that. If you're listening, you can do that via Instagram or via Twitter at Politicon. Or you can send us your questions via email, podcasts@politicon.com. These were specifically for you, Carter. Joyce from LA asks, should Snowden, Assange, and Reality Winner be pardoned?
I'm open to consideration of those ideas. I certainly, I think there's, and this is a recent Ninth Circuit decision that the activities which were uncovered in terms of the Snowden leaks, I mean, these are illegal things that were being done, right? So in that sense, it's a positive, but I'm not well positioned. Again, I think it's important, similar to what we were debating, it's better to have the full picture, and I'm not fully versed on it, but I would certainly be open to consideration of those concepts.
Hannah from Richmond asks, is any agency or branch of government trustworthy?
There's a great quote by Reagan, trust but verify, right? And I think what has been a challenge for the U.S. intelligence community is a lack of openness. And actually, this goes back to the Snowden question as well, right? Because he took pretty proactive steps and without question broke the law related to that. But, you know, I think it's important to have trust, but trust is something you have to earn. And unfortunately, through a lot of abuses, there are some major problems that have not been fully addressed. And so I think it's always good to have a healthy level of skepticism and ask the right questions. And that's a great example of a good question. So appreciate it.
Okay. Riley from New York. What's something Americans misunderstand about Russia?
I think overall, that's a good summary question in conclusion of what we've been talking about. I think there are countless misunderstandings. And it's the old, like the old Sting song, do the Russians love their children too, right? I mean, I think it's important to look at people as human beings and to constantly have a, closed-minded rhetoric is a serious problem. So I think it's important to understand and to have a fuller, deeper picture of the country, their culture, their economy, and their people, which I think is not well understood by anyone. And I would encourage the questioner to actually go visit over there, because I think you can
well,
learn a lot.
Let me change Riley's question. Sorry, Riley. Because I want to change it a little bit, because I agree with you. And I honestly think most Americans, or I would hope most Americans would agree with you that we should have respect for the human beings who live in Russia and recognize that they love their children too. Yes. So let me change the question, because I'm curious. What's something Americans misunderstand about Vladimir Putin? Because there's a difference between saying Russia and talking about Russians versus talking about the Kremlin and talking about Putin. And I don't know that there are many, I don't encounter many people in this country who are afraid of Russians, the people. But I do encounter quite a few folks as I speak who are very apprehensive about Vladimir Putin and his control over that country and its government and its armed forces and its nuclear arsenal, et cetera. So let me ask you this. What's something Americans misunderstand about Vladimir Putin?
I think, and let me be very clear and upfront about I lack knowledge. I, similar to a lot of top leaders in the United States, I have actually I've never met Vladimir Putin at any time in my life. So, you know, again, I think it's important to have a direct dialogue with individuals and keep an open mind until you actually have that kind of engagement.
Yeah. Well, I'll say trust but verify on that Vladimir Putin issue. And I got to say, some of the stuff that I've seen happening or some of the reports that I've heard, at least, certainly give me pause and make me concerned that while we shouldn't be afraid of Russians and the people of Russia, that perhaps there are some things going on with Vladimir Putin and his leadership of that country that and that his leadership towards interfering with our country that may be cause for concern. But
let me just push back a little bit, because I think this goes back to what we talked about with Iraq, right? And this is in the verification. I think the prior question about, you know, trusting government agencies, et cetera. You know, not all the information, and I can say this without question from firsthand experience, not all the intelligence is correct when it comes to these questions. So I think it's, it requires a deeper level of thought and less of a, jumping to conclusions, I would say, because there's a lot more that needs to be understood. And I think, again, this is an example where engaging in a dialogue and on a number of levels, not just on a presidential level, but, even on a societal level, like we're talking about, people to people, I think that can be important in terms of turning a corner so that the next 70 years for our respective countries does not match what we've seen over the last 70 years, which is, as they say in Dr. Strange, love toe-to-toe with the Ruskies, right? Nuclear, on the brink of nuclear conflict. And, these are real significant, potentially catastrophic risks that should be more thoughtfully and thoroughly addressed.
Do you think Dan Coats has got any has any validity to his belief? Do you think Vladimir Putin has anything on Trump?
I can't imagine that he does. All I know, just based on the most infamous source, in terms of that infamous Steele dossier that were paid for, yes, by both Democrats and Republicans, in terms of the initial work, at least with Fusion GPS, I think there's there are a lot of errors in everything that they wrote about me in that document is inaccurate. So
would Dan Coats think that, though? I mean, he's a senator from Indiana he's known international affairs for quite a while. Why would he think that? Why would he even joke about it? Why would he make the even if he was kidding, why would he say that? Unless he thought that perhaps Trump was giving Putin what he wanted.
It's a safe space. It's consistent with the status quo rhetoric, which has defined our country since after the Second World War. So it's a big problem. And it's something that, it takes a different approach, and it takes a more open mind to think through some potential new solutions, which I think is important.
How the heck are we going to get along here in the U.S.?
Well, I think this actually ties in well, right? I mean, I think, and it's the same type of problems in many ways. I think having an open mind and being willing to engage in dialogue as opposed to immediately pointing fingers at the other side, I think that's absolutely essential in terms of turning the corner. And, I think these same conflicts we've seen over the course of the last several months and, throughout the 2020 cycle is exactly the same thing I've been calling for many, many years. And particularly, even in the deep trials that I went through in this historic juncture that we've gone through with the original Russia stories in the last presidential election. So I think it's important to come at things with an open mind. And I think even though people are very much taking a stance of, you know, constant confrontation. I think having a more open-minded and a more willingness to engage, although risky in some ways, just based on the false rhetoric, it's absolutely essential if we're going to get to new solutions.
Well, people can read about your story in Abuse and Power, How an Innocent American Was Framed in an Attempted Coup Against the President. Carter Page, thank you so much for getting along with us today and for sharing your story and your insights and your thoughts. We really appreciate that. You guys, if you're listening and you enjoyed the podcast, please like and rate and comment and subscribe and all that other stuff you do to podcasts. And we'll be back here next week for another episode of How the Heck Are We Gonna Get Along?